Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Okay, good evening. Masal khair, marhaba, welcome. Since its inception in 2009, the NYU AD Institute in Abu Dhabi in New York has provided a platform for exchange about the newest developments in research and scholarship across the disciplines. The Institute in New York offers the Washington Square community opportunities to hear experts talk about their research and its social relevance, technological and cultural impact, and importance for the world at large, ranging from artistic and creative innovations to issues of equality and inclusion, public health, and environmental sustainability, among many others. As a hub for vibrant scholarly public engagement, the Institute is unparalleled in the Gulf region, and we are pleased to offer programming and extend the Institute's reach here at 19 Washington Square North, NYU Abu Dhabi's home here in New York City. My name is Jonathan Shannon, and I'm happy to present tonight's panel, Boom Diwan, Musical Cosmopolitanisms from the Arabian Gulf to the Swahili Coast. This is at the beginning of a week-long residency here in New York City at Joe's Pub for the Kuwaiti music ensemble, Boom Diwan. The panel will be exploring the history and intercultural dynamics of musical cultures in the Arabian Gulf and Africa's Swahili coast. Based in mercantile trade and cultural exchanges dating back many centuries, the musics of the Gulf and Western Indian Ocean have developed uniquely rich in cosmopolitan song forms and styles that are infrequently heard and less frequently explored and studied here in the West. Many audience members here in the US are well acquainted now with Arab music, given the large number of Arab and Arab American musicians and ensembles in the US and across North Africa and North America, as well as their growing influence in world music circles, amongst others. However, American audiences are typically well acquainted with musics from the Arab Levant, namely Egypt and what used to be called Greater Syria, including modern-day Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. North African musical cultures are less well known, but even today, such North African styles as the Moroccan Gnawa music have gained sizable audiences. However, the musics of the Khalij, or Arabian Gulf, remain less well known. Even in academic circles, they remain understudied, less obvious subjects of field research, and often only when political instabilities have made research in the Levantine areas less feasible. For this reason, we are thrilled to have two emerging experts on the musics of the Khalij and its broader Indian Ocean nexus. Today, we'll hear from Professor Ghazil Mulefi, visiting assistant professor of music at NYU Abu Dhabi and founder of the Boom Diwan Ensemble. In addition, we'll have Andrew Eisenberg, associate professor of music and program head of music at NYU Abu Dhabi. The two of them will explore their ongoing research at this important musical nexus, and I will moderate a conversation afterwards. We'll begin with Ghazi, who will be giving a presentation on musics of the Khalij, and then we'll have a short musical interlude followed by a presentation by Professor Eisenberg on his work in the Swahili coast, and then we'll end the evening with some question and answer and a short musical performance. Thank you very much. And Ghazi Al-Mulefi, please join us.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for being here. It's nice to see familiar faces and new faces. I'd like to take a moment and thank everybody at 19 Washington Square North for their warm hospitality and for hosting us today. So music of the Khalij. The Gulf is a small area, geographically speaking, and I think one common assumption is that the music of the Gulf must all sound similar, and it must all come from the Gulf. And one of the things I try to do as I think about Bahri music or music of the sea is to complicate that idea, since it was music born of trade and exchange within the context of the Indian Ocean, Western Indian Ocean civilization world. Here's a map of the Western Indian Ocean. On the northwest part of it is where the Arabian Peninsula is. And the main ports of engagement from the Kuwaiti sailors and pearl divers took place on the eastern coast, northeastern coast of Africa, the Swahili coast, and the western coast of India. And just to give a really kind of, I guess, for lack of a better word, a crash course into what took place. There was a main pearl diving season in Kuwait that took place from April until September. And that's when all the pearls were being harvested by pearl divers. Of course, there's a musical tradition that went along with this lifeway. But then in the fall season, these pearls would then be taken to India and traded for other goods before the sailors would return back to Kuwait and also to the Swahili coast for getting wood and other materials to build homes and so on, and boats. And so in the interim, while the merchants were unloading their goods, there'd be about a 3 or 4 month span of time where the sailors really had nothing to do except play music and play music with people at the local ports before returning home. So a lot of the music that we have and a lot of the instruments that we have that you'll hear later don't come from the geographic area that is Kuwait. They come from the Swahili coast and India mostly. Another thing I should say is I'm an heir to this tradition. My family were all pearl divers and seafarers and shipmasters. And before I decided to start learning this music, I really kind of was thinking about, you know, what are the situations that occasioned it and where does it exist today, even residually, since the lifeways, namely pearl diving, is no longer in existence. In fact, it's illegal right now. But the government sponsors an annual pearl diving expedition. And for me, I thought this was the closest that I could get to experiencing this practice corporeally. And so I'm going to try to be cognizant of time because I can really kind of go off on this. But so I went on a pearl diving trip where I met some of the musicians you will see today. And this pearl diving trip took 10 days and was off the coast of Kuwait at a Coast Guard station of Kairan. And I was really curious about how this practice was transmitted from the government, in this case, to the youth of Kuwait. So 100 Kuwaiti boys would go out on this pearl diving expedition and would be taught by the now late Khalifa Nuhid al-Rashid, who was a shipmaster who would teach all of us how to pearl dive. And we spent about 10 days out at sea. It's about 120 degrees and very humid, and it had a physically and psychologically taxing element. And the reason why I bring this up is because, you know, music doesn't exist in a vacuum. It comes from somewhere. It comes from somewhere, both in the physical sense, but also from the psychological sense, from the spiritual sense. And this Bahri music is a spiritual music. So also as an heir to this tradition, I'm curious to see it as how this practice is being taught. And so here's me learning how to pearl dive. And what I mean by that is this practice was never meant to be taught governmentally, since the time that it existed was in the pre-national. And so it's very, very interesting to me to see how it would be transmitted, what would be included, what would be excluded. And what I found was that the people who had us, invited us to the Sea Sports Club in Kuwait, which is a government entity, were very sensitive about what we're going to photograph and video, because they were really, concerned with us showing things that may not be authentic to the public, which of course are all the things that I was really curious about. As I mentioned, on this trip, I met some of the musicians who you'll hear later today. And these musicians are heirs to this pearl diving life, this pearling life, but also we have these places called diwaniyas. And a diwaniya is basically a salon. It's usually a home, a room in a home that has a separate access from the rest of the house, for basically to keep it as a private space so you're not disturbing the families. In Kuwait, we have 4 music diwaniyas. We have the Ben Hussein diwaniya, we have the Ma'if al-Jalli diwaniya, Al-Amiri Diwaniya, and Al-Mas. These are the four pearl diving families that really, on a weekly basis, as a live practice, take care of this tradition and play this music. And so I belong to the Ma'yuf Mjalli Diwaniya, and you see the gentleman in the center with his hands clapping, is the late Sleiman Ma'yuf Mjalli, who was the second generation of leading this band. And so I spent a lot of time with the Ma'yuf Mjalli ensemble, and I spent a lot of time in their Diwaniya trying to understand what they did and how they took care of this music and the public face and the private face. So I'm going to play a clip of one of these gatherings. So the Diwaniya is also an archival space. It's a place where all of this information, all of this music is really contained in the body and passed corporeally from generation to generation. In these Diwaniyas, you see children who may be 1 or 2 years old up until, you know, people who are grandparents and great-grandparents. And it's a sacred space. It's a space where that we have to really respect. You know, there's no profanity in the Diwaniya. There's no smoking in the Diwaniya. There's an emphasis on cleanliness in the Diwaniya. And so what you just heard was a rhythm called Haddadi. And this is a recreational genre of music. There's two basic categories of Bahri music. There's ins, which comes from the word wanasa, which means to have fun. And there's funun bahar, which just means the sea arts, which are the work songs. I'll show you in the next video an example of the late Sleiman Ma'yuf Mjalli teaching his Diwaniya to play a work song called Dawari, which means circular, because it usually happens in a procession of two circles when pearl divers are pulling an anchor at the end of a long day. So basically, when pearl diving happens, usually we start, there's a series of pearl banks, and we start by anchoring the ship at the first one, if you will, if the current's going this way. And by the end of the day, and after harvesting oysters from many of these pearl banks, there's a very long anchor rope that has to be pulled in order for the anchor to be pulled up. So they sing Dawari and play Dawari in order to make this difficult task sacred and to transcend the mundane and really difficult task that it is. So the Diwaniya, I said, is an archive, but it's also a place where we reenact histories. And these histories are really the last that exist residually. They're the last pieces that we have. So the Diwaniya is also a memorial space. I'm going to go to the hospital. So this idea of the diwan is really, really important. So we have musical diwans, but we also have diwans where we discuss family problems, make business deals, hang out. But the music diwan is really unique to Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar. Those are the three places where we really take care of this music. So one thing I'll say before I move on to talking about boom diwan is none of the instruments in the Bahri repertoire come from Kuwait. The tabla al-Bahri, which you'll see later in more detail, was brought by the Bin Hussein family in the late 1930s to Kuwait. And this one is actually made by Hamid Bin Hussein's uncle, came from India. The halas, which are the clay pots, are originally water storage devices. And those, the mud from the halas comes from Iran and Iraq. The marwas is found in the Swahili coast, it's found in Arabia, and it's found in Indonesia. What's really important to me is that not all of these instruments defy an origin story. In many ways, I think this music defies an origin story. So what it means for this music to be Kuwaiti for me means is really comprised of all these engagements in the Western Indian Ocean civilization world, these connectivities that exist in the historical document that is this music. So as I see this music performed as heritage and heritage events in Kuwait, I get annoyed, honestly. I feel like this music is placed in a artificial, display case, that it's not moving, that it's not free. The situation that occasioned this music was actually playfulness, exchange, unintentionality about what it was going to be, because the people who created it had no concept of the nation, weren't really thinking about heritage or culture, they were just surviving. And this music really reflected their sense of freedom, their sense of adventure, their sense of play, their creativity. So as heirs to this tradition, it's very important to us to reclaim that spirit, to take play very seriously, to respect the music, to learn it in the Diwaniya, and at the same time, to set it free. So as I was conducting ethnographic interviews with these Diwaniyas, in my studio in Kuwait, they noticed I had other instruments laying around my studio, and they invited me to play with them. And as a fan of jazz and global jazz, I really was waiting for this opportunity. So this is when Boom Diwan was created. So just to tell you a little bit about the name, the boom is the most important ship in Kuwaiti history. It's a model of a ship used for pearl diving and seafaring. So it acts as a metaphor for exploration and reaching out. The Diwan is a place where we welcome people. So it's a place where we welcome collaborators. So it's about really going out and exploring and also and influencing and also welcoming and being influenced in return. So this was the first kind of experiment. The thing we were wondering about during this experiment is whether or not this would be legible, whether or not we were creating some kind of Frankenstein's monster by just like combining different genres of music, or whether it was something that we really felt really inhabited the kind of spirits that we were looking for. And to, you know, to my great delight, and I'm very grateful to say that we really felt it. We really felt that we're putting this music in the right place. And as a collaborative ensemble, we've been able to reach out beyond the Western Indian Ocean world and have collaborations with the Duduza Makatini from South Africa, with Arturo Farrell, who we're playing with later this week, and Jean-Michel Pilk, among other people. But the whole point is, the reason for us, this is about a reclamation of the spirit. It's about putting the music back to where it needs to be. Of course, the Diwan, where we conserve it and take, you know, preserve the history corporeally and transmit it from generation to generation, is really the most important thing, because without that, we're just playing into the ether. But for me, Boom Diwan is an extension of that Diwaniya. And so we were invited by, how am I doing on time then? Yeah. Okay. So once we figured out that we liked what we were doing, we were invited by Arturo O'Farrell, who was creating this project called the Cuban Khaliji Project, which premiered at the Art Center in Wai Abu Dhabi in 2019, to really uncover some bridges. So there's this book by Ned Sublett, of course it's from NYU, called Cuba and Its Music, which traced the migration of slaves from the Swahili coast to the Arabian Peninsula, to North Africa, the Iberian Peninsula, and then to Afro-Cuba. And so Bill Bragan, the director of the Arts Center, was telling me about Arturo O'Farrell and how he's trying to connect the Western Indian Ocean and the Atlantic vis-a-vis the history of the slave trade, which I thought in the beginning was a little bit of a far-fetched idea, until the musicians from Boom Diwan and the musicians from the Afro Latin Jazz Orchestra, the percussionists in particular, were playing in the middle of a rehearsal. We had a break, and they were both claiming that what they were playing was theirs. You know, these guys were saying, "Oh no, this is like a Khaliji rumba or shar," and the percussionist in Arturo O'Farrell's band were saying, no, this is like a bomba or a plena. So they really had, like, they recognized this, each other in this music. And, you know, one could say that there's, you know, that could be a little bit anecdotal, but at the same time, I think it's important not to dismiss the recognition that they had in each other in that moment. So I'll play a clip of this collaboration. Thank you. For Boom Diwan to be invited into Arturo O'Farrell's space. And it was the first time we were asked to share our music, you know, in this new way outside of our Diwan yet. Obviously we're playing again this Friday. So all these years later, we continue to collaborate. But there were some interesting negotiations that happen with the responsibility of being caretakers of this music. I'll play one more musical example, and then I think I'm out of time. So we decided to then open the Diwan and invite Ndudu Zamakatini to play with us from South Africa. He's a Blue Notes artist and a professor of music. He came to Abu Dhabi to play with us in the Arts Center. We recorded an album with him, and I will, which made it to New York Times, but I will just play one quick clip, because with this one, you'll hear some traditional singing in the beginning with my colleague Abdulaziz Al-Hamili and myself singing the opening lines to the same piece called the Dawari that you heard with the anchor ropes.
بيت الرسول مكة يا مدينة هلا بيت الرسول مكة يا مدينة بيت الرسول مكة يا مدينة هلا بيت الرسول مكة يا مدينة بيت
This was recorded during the pandemic in Kuwait in the bottom left, in South Africa in the top middle, and then the corners and the drums. And so, speaking of the reception of this music as more than experiments, this album was written up in Bandcamp as, you know, one of the best jazz albums in November 21. But I mean, the point is that this experiment went beyond our, it's the way it's been received has really beyond our wildest dreams. So I think that's all I have for you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ghazi. Now we're going to be blessed by a short performance by members of the Boom Diwan Ensemble. Faddalu.
So I'd like to introduce Hamid Saeed, Abdullah Mtairi, Hamid bin Hussein, and Muhammad bin Bakr. Haddadi. So they're going to play a piece called Haddadi. Haddadi means on the edge. It could be the edge of a knife, but in this case, it's the edge of the sea and the deserts. And it's a recreational rhythm.
Ah.
Shukran jazilan. Thank you very much. Beautiful. Next, I'd like to invite Professor Andrew Eisenberg to the podium to talk about his research in a very different part of this larger Indian Ocean nexus. Please join me in welcoming Professor Eisenberg.
I don't know if that's easy or hard to follow, but it's beautiful anyway. Thank you all for being here. Thank you to the 19 Washington Square North. I'm really pleased to be here. As Ghazi sort of alluded to, the music that we just experienced is connected historically to the music of the Swahili coast. Ghazi and I have been engaged in an ongoing dialogue about this since we met in 2017 or 2016 or so. And as you can imagine, it's great having a colleague like that. You can talk about these connections that are not really written about all that much. And the musicians themselves on the Swahili coast and in Kuwait, they have their own narratives about this, but they don't get together themselves and talk about this very much. We're actually, next week, doing a little bit of that work in Abu Dhabi. I'm bringing a Swahili musician I've known for 20 years to perform with some of the part of Boom Diwan that'll be there at an event that you're all invited to, but it's in Abu Dhabi. So my forthcoming book, which comes out in just under a month now, approaches this theme of these connections from the direction of East Africa's Swahili coast. So I explore in this book a 70-year history of musicians in the Kenyan coastal city of Mombasa appropriating Indian and Arab sounds in their music. Now, my aim in this book is not just to think about Kenyan Swahili musicians and their music, but actually to think with them about the complexities of identity and belonging and culture on the Swahili coast. I take them to be theorists themselves, although they're working through a musical medium rather than through words necessarily. So for that reason, I focus specifically on the intentional appropriations of Indian Arab sounds. We can all, it's really, really easy to find the sort of organic kind of hybridization that's been going on. Everything in Swahili music is somehow borrowing from Arab music, from Indian music. And what I focus on in this book is the very intentional borrowings, uses of Indian Arab and Arab sounds through parody, through pastiche, because in those intentional appropriations are really reflections or like reflexive commentaries on identity and belonging. So my presentation today is about the late musician Ustad Zain Labdin Ahmed Alamoudi, who happens to grace the cover of my book, and his creative appropriations of sounds from the Arabian Peninsula. Zain was a really important figure in the history of Swahili tarab music. And tarab is a genre of instrumentally accompanied Swahili sung poetry that first appeared around the turn of the 20th century as a form of refined entertainment for elite men and women of Swahili coastal society, and then evolved into a popular music enjoyed by all classes of society. Swahili tarab has taken different stylistic paths in different regions of the coast over the past century or so. So when you encounter like an example of Swahili tarab, it might be totally different than what you hear right now. Or if you've encountered one before, you encounter one again, because there are multiple varieties of it. It centers on poetry. So the poetry, because poetry is at the center, music can take all these different directions. The style of tarab for which Zain Labdin became very well known in the latter half of the 20th century is something that he called Arab tarab, or tarab ya kiarabu. And of course, most forms of tarab are to some extent Arab, but Arab tarab is more robustly Arab in both its sonic form and its social settings. The primary context for Arab tarab is the men's wedding celebration, which is a tradition associated with Swahili and Arab men of the Swahili coast. So Swahili-speaking Arabs like Zayn himself, that an Arab style of music would be popular among men who consider themselves Arab is not surprising. But a closer listen to this music or Zayn's form of it really shows that he was really exploring and really interested in exploring Swahili culture. So Arab Taarab for him was actually a forum or a venue for exploring what it meant to be Swahili. And he worked very closely with this renowned poet and intellectual from the Kenyan coast, Sheikh Ahmed Sheikh Nabhani. And much of Nabhani's career was oriented around the task of documenting and preserving what he saw as authentic Swahili culture. Nabhani's program of conservation, as it's been called, found very fertile ground in the 1970s. As elsewhere in the region, in Mombasa in the 1970s, you had social norms that were undergoing rapid change. And so there was a lot of reflection and debate about among Swahili-speaking Muslims, in the, you know, about what is their tradition, what is their culture. And at the same time, as is evident of writings from the era of by Swahili intellectuals, the Kenyan coast was seeing the rise of a Swahili ethnic consciousness. So the idea of being Swahili really starts to emerge in the 1970s as a result of social and economic marginalization of coastal Muslims in independent Kenya. Situated on the margin of an African nation state in which political recognition and power accrued to so-called tribes, Kenya's Swahili-speaking coastal Muslims were beginning to embrace the idea that they were part of a unitary ethnic group, a tribe. So the idea of Swahili identity sort of emerges at this time when Nabhani is writing poems about what it means to be Swahili and advising scholars. He undertook a whole career in being an advisor to anthropologists and literary theorists. So Zayn and Nabhani, their association and their work together began in the 1970s when Nabhani became a regular guest at Zayn's Maskani, which is an Arab-style men's social gathering centered on coffee, chewing khat, and conversation. And the Maskani is essentially a Swahili version of the Diwania. This is something we've talked about, Ghazi and I, and they're historically connected as well. And that's something that actually Zayn knew very well because he understood the culture of the pearl diving musicians in Kuwait, and he was fascinated by it. I'll get to that in a bit. Now, it's a little wonder that Zayn would have sought out Nabhani, that Nabhani would have sought out Zayn in the 1970s. First of all, they were both around the same age. Both they were born in the 1930s. They're both hailed from the area of north of Mombasa, the port town of Lamu. They're both from around there. And Lamu was a really important center for culture and the arts in the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. And it was just starting to decline when they were both born. So they're both very nostalgic about Lamu. They knew a lot of poets and intellectuals from there and learned about those that had passed away before they were born. So in delving into their work together in the 1970s, which I did for this book, I identified specific projects that the two men undertook together, each of which used new and borrowed poetic and musical materials in particular ways. And these were really, and I write about it not only in the book, but also some other materials that couldn't make it into the book. They were really working together as scholars as well as artists. They were using art as a form of scholarship. They're really doing practice research, basically, although they didn't talk about it that way. So I described this one project, which I want to talk about here, as their project of cultural ambiguity. And the musical settings that Zayn composed as part of this project of cultural ambiguity all present musical expressions as in some way belonging to both the Arabian Peninsula and the Swahili coast. So I want to take the time I have here to talk about some of these and just to have you experience some of these. So let's first to talk about the Hadhrami dimension here. So the Hadhrami Arabs hail from southern Yemen. It's a large diaspora in the Western Indian Ocean. Zain is actually was a member of that diaspora and not a member of that diaspora. He was an insider, outsider. He was Hadhrami descent, but since his family came, he said in the 14th century, maybe a little later than that, he was an old Arab, and therefore he was considered to be Swahili or Arab, but in a specific sense. Whereas Hadhramis were more recently arrived, and traditionally the Hadhramis were not called Arabs because most of them were from a lower social caste. And so they weren't Arabs. So Zain was an Arab. He didn't speak Arabic as a native language. Those who spoke Arabic as a native language who were Hadhrami were not Arabs. It's very complex. So there's a Hadhrami dimension to this cultural ambiguity project where some of the songs that Zain composed settings for, and I say composed settings because, so the poetry is at the center, right? And Zain wrote some of his poems that he set to music. Nabhani wrote some of the poems that Zain set to music. Other poets that were living at the time also wrote for Zain. And Nabhani also brought historical poems from the 19th century and 20th century, early 20th century, to Zain, and they worked together to set those poems. So Nabhani and Zain would sit at the Maskani or the Swahili Diwania, and they would actually work together to figure out how to set these. So some of the compositions that he set were borrowing very intentionally, again, from Hadhrami music. Zain knew Hadhrami music really well. He played at Hadhrami weddings, so he knew Southern Yemeni music. And what I'm going to play for you here is one song that a setting that's inspired by, it's almost directly borrowing a melody from a very famous composer. So I'll play for you first the melody from the composer, Saeed Marzouq. And then I'll play Zain's composition. The performance of the Hadhrami composition is just a cappella, there's no rhythm to it. Then you'll hear Zain's version, which puts it to a rhythm that, and this is also very intentional, that is both Swahili and Hadhrami. It's a chakacha rhythm, which is also recognized by Hadhramis as sharh, or what's actually called Swahili. So the understanding that this is a rhythm that actually exists in both places. So I'll play these for you first. مرت بصفح الجبال مثل I think it was that short. Sorry. حيال لي جميلة مرت بصفح الجبال مثل
لن يلغزكما كسي مكيني سوى بوجكنين وتكنيني يغيبا كنتوما أبي قولي يغيبا كنتوما أبي قولي
So there are some also examples that of this cultural ambiguity project which focus on kind of broadly Khaliji sounds. This is a really good example here with Zain's setting for a turn of the 20th century poem here, Kamba Hai Pigui Fundo. Which takes the melody and the associated rhythmic figures, instrumental figures, from a very popular Khaliji Arab song, which was made famous by a Bahraini musician, Ahmed Al-Jumairi, in the 1980s. So I'll just play these side by side here. Sorry, these are so short. I was trying to keep it short on time, but now they're cut off and it's like, I want to keep listening. So this is interesting. Well, first of all, it's another exploration of rhythms that this could be recognized as a Swahili rhythm. This could also be recognized as a Khaliji rhythm. So that's one thing that's going on there. But the other is, note that this early 20th century or turn of the 20th century poem fits perfectly, and the prosody fits perfectly with this Khaliji song composed in the 1980s. And that's not accidental, or it's accidental, but it's not a coincidental, that there is this connection. The poetic traditions of the Arabian Peninsula are connected historically to the poetic traditions of the Swahili coast. So the final example here brings us full circle here. So Zain had a real passion for Kuwaiti music, or he just called it Kuwaiti music, but specifically he was talking about this genre of urban art song called salt or song. And this started out, this passion started out when he was a child and he was exposed to salt at his father's maskani. So during his childhood, Zain's father held regular gatherings with his uncle, who was known as the best musician in the region, and other local musicians. And occasionally they were joined by musicians from Kuwait, who had worked aboard trading vessels, and they were plying the waters between the Kenyan coast and the Arabian Peninsula. And Kuwaiti crews almost always included skilled musicians, as Kuwaitis considered music a really important part of seafaring, as we've just heard about. And according to Zain's uncle, Baskuta, it was Kuwaiti musicians who initially introduced Baskuta to the oud. And Baskuta was known as the first oud player in Lamu. So basically, Kuwaitis brought the oud to the Kenyan coast. So salt originated in the 19th century as a cosmopolitan genre performed not only in the urban salons of the Arabian Peninsula, but also alongside the dominant sea music on the trading boats in Kuwait. So all of these diwaniyas in Kuwait, and this is, I'll play for you in a minute, one of them that's represented among Boom Diwan also. In the 1980s, Baskuta told the German ethnomusicologist Werner Graebner that musicians and audiences in 1930s Lamu had realized that the dances from the Arabian Peninsula fit with the traditional rhythms from Lamu. And Baskuta told this ethnomusicologist that this spoke to an earlier link between these traditions. So the Kuwaiti settings that Zain composed in collaboration with Nabahani basically constitute explorations of his uncle's hypothesis. And all of them use poems from Lamu's golden age, the late 19th century, early 20th century, which would have been the same era when Kuwaiti sailors first started bringing salt to the Swahili coast. So I want to play for you another side-by-side here. And Zain's song is his setting for a turn of the 20th century poem, Maneno Tisia, nine words. It's a really interesting case because this song in particular, although when I did my field work in Mombasa and hung out with Zane for many hours, he never talked about this, but somehow earlier when he did a international release with Werner Graebner, that German ethnomusicologist I mentioned, the liner notes that Graebner wrote mentioned that this song that you'll hear, and I'll play it side by side with Salt, with an example of Salt, that it's, they didn't mention the rhythm as Salt or as Kuwaiti, but as something called Twari Landia, which just means drum of the street. And it's an old men's traditional dance. And so the idea was that Salt, the Salt rhythm and the Twari Landia rhythm were the same. And I'm not sure if that's actually true, because the few recordings I have, Twari Landia is not performed anymore. I have some recordings from 1950s, and they're not actually the same rhythm, but they're similar. They're like spacious rhythms, as you'll hear in this example of Salt. So let me play these side by side here. I'll just say a few words in conclusion here, although it's not the conclusion of our entire presentation, but just to conclude this part. So given the long history of the Swahili coast as a cultural contact zone, and the general understanding among local denizens that their society is a mixture, they often, people on the Swahili coast will say Swahili society is an mchanganyiko, or a mixture. Any conception of Swahili culture as something that can and should be conserved necessarily runs up against this paradox, the paradox of authentic hybridity. How can you have like a kind of hybridity that's authentic? So Sheikh Nabahani never addressed this paradox in a satisfactory fashion in his writings. And he always kind of left open the question of how Swahili culture can be syncretic on the one hand, and also have an authentic form and a locatable origin in time and space. He left that tension there in his work. And this is not just me saying this, it's others who have examined his work very closely and taken his writings, taken them on as in dialogue. But through his work with Zane, he contributed to the development of a theoretical model of Swahili culture that is capable of dissolving the paradox. Zane's, what I call his musical poetics of cultural ambiguity, offers an image of Swahili culture as an emergent property of processes of appropriation and indigenization. And this is like, we can imagine it like a sailing vessel that's unquestionably local, but constructed in part from foreign materials. This is a powerful answer to the paradox of authentic hybridity, and it's one that deserves to catch the ears of those scholars who are engaged in writing about culture and history in the Indian Ocean world. Thank you. This is my book. Shameless plug at
the end. Shameless plug going on there. QR code. It's an excellent book. I had the privilege of reading early versions of it. Thank you to both Professors Al-Muleifi and Eisenberg.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.